years after I had been married, he said, you need from this point on to dedicate yourself to becoming a student of women, because right now you don't know anything. The only growth, I will tell you, that I've had in my knowledge of Veronica over these past 8 years has been growth in what I know that I don't understand. So ladies, at the very beginning, I will tell you, I implore you to be gracious with us this morning, men, specifically me, as we will let my lack of wisdom hopefully be covered up by Solomon's great wisdom. If you are just joining us, this is a 7-ish week series on sex, dating, love, and romance. And I will say at the outset that while different subjects of these 7 or so weeks are going to apply to maybe more to you at some stage in life, I would suggest that all of them will be applicable really to everybody. Because while, you know, 1 week is maybe right exactly what you're in or you're going through or what you want to go through, there are some implications. We'll try to draw those out that are going to be for you kind of wherever you are, because I'm talking about something that affects everybody, okay? I will also tell you that this is our second week specifically on that, on dating. Dating has got to be, as you know, one of the most exciting and simultaneously one of the absolute worst times of your life. In fact, I got tense this week, no joke, as I was working through all this, remembering how awkward and uncertain that period of my life was, you know, trying to figure out if she is the one or if you need to break up with her or if she's about to dump you. And I just remembered what a traumatic, it was awesome, it was exciting, but it was just, I know some of you, and I even bring this up, you get this tense feeling in your stomach because you don't like to be there, you don't want to be there again, or maybe you're right in the middle of it. One of the worst times that I can remember was when a girl, a girlfriend that I had in college, and I broke up on a week-long mission trip that I was leading. It was a group of only about 6 people, and we broke up right about halfway through the week. I was actually going to bring it up after the week was over, but you know, she sniffed it out in that way that girls can do, and somehow forced the conversation. And there it was. So we had the rest of the week to go together. In fact, we had some pictures taken of the group that week, and some of them were developed. And, you know, on the trip, she was looking at one of them. And there's she and I together, and she rips it in half and throws it back in my face in front of everybody and said, there's your unity in Christ for you. You know, so I feel your pain. I remember, and honestly don't want to go back there. So how's that for encouraging? Each week, I have given you homework and will again today. In addition to that, or part of that really, I've issued what I'm calling the date night challenge, which I realize sounds a little cheesy, but it gets the point across. And that is, for those of you that are married or engaged or even really seriously dating, for 7 weeks now in a row, okay, this would be your second week, and for 5 more weeks, to go out on a date. And what I mean by that is that you don't go sit at a restaurant and watch the Final Four, like anybody would actually be interested in that anymore anyway. But I don't mean that. I don't mean you go somewhere and you watch SportsCenter. I mean that you go to a restaurant and that you, especially for those of you that are married, you sit down and you actually just talk about the things that I'm bringing up these 6 or 7 weeks. You know, some of the weeks I'm giving you specific questions like I will today on what I want you to talk about during that time. Others times you can just take your notes or things you remember and you can work through this stuff, because one of the best things that will come out of this is not that you've heard 7 lectures that are somehow going to revolutionize your romance life. It's that you learn to communicate and that you learn to talk through these things, because as I will mention today, that's really part of the chief problem with that. So that's the date night challenge. You got it? I don't want to know, girls, if your deadbeat thug husband didn't do it last week, but he's got another week to redeem himself. I will go ahead and tell you, you say, are you doing this? Absolutely. In fact, I set the bar pretty high. I went with my wife this week and got a pedicure. Well, that's right. Sat in a chair next to her. My toes are a lovely shade of mauve right now. No, I didn't get my toes painted, but I did sit there. And so I've set the bar, and if I can go through that, then you can do it too, guys. I just did it for Jesus and for you and her. We're also going to sponsor. We're going to try to put our money where our mouth is. Listen, there's a reason we're doing this. I'm very serious about this. We are going to actually pay. All right, we are going to pay for you to do this. We're going to pay for your dinner one night. April 25th is the date. We're going to pay for it. Actually, at least part of it. Depends on what kind of restaurants you go to. Many of the staff are going to keep your kids, if you have kids, because we are very serious about this, because this is one of the things that you most need, some of you, in doing this. Okay, that's April 25th. You'll hear more about that. This Thursday, if you are single or a young professional in what we are now calling the Bay Area, we are having a young professional event. We are calling it a stoplight event, where you're supposed to wear green if you are available, red if you are taken, and yellow if you're available but thinking about, red if you're taken but thinking about being available. I'm totally kidding. That actually is exactly the opposite of what our young professional stuff does. In fact, this Thursday they're talking about ministry, not talking about that. That's very much not the image that they have. But you can, you'll see more information about that. It is in the Bay Area. It will be a great event, especially now. Don't wear red, green, or yellow because of what it will communicate. We have also made a number of resources that are available for you, books for you to read, a marriage seminar at the exposed table, tent, whatever it is out there. And we, for our Summit Life groups, many of them are going along in a companion study along with this. It's not too late for you to actually join up with a Summit Life group doing that. And you can stop by there and find out more information. Because I'll say this. What you really need, again, is not seven lectures on it, is that you need to be in a community of people that are going to help foster this type of spiritual growth. We believe here at the Summit Church, the Summit Life Group, small groups are the incubators of spiritual growth. And really, no matter how many lectures you hear, how many sermons, no matter how good they are, really, it's not really going to take root for some of you until you get involved in that type of group. And these are groups at every stage of life, and you'll want to find out more about that because that could be the absolute best thing that would come out of this series is for you to get connected in one of these groups. I am not exaggerating to say that we have marriages in our church that have been saved by the fact they were in a Summit Life group. And that's no exaggeration. That's what needs to happen for some of you as well. We're also doing these seminars. You see that in your thing. We do them once a month. The next one's coming up this weekend, and I'm teaching it. It's on Saturday. You'll see more information about that. There's a little card you can pick up that tells you all about it. And we do it because we are very committed to your family and to your marriage. Okay? All right. Song of Solomon. You ready? We're going to pick up right where we left off last week. We're in chapter 2. We're going to begin at verse 8. If you're trying to find Song of Solomon in your Bible, it's right about halfway through the Old Testament. It's right after Ecclesiastes, which is after Proverbs, which is right after Psalms. And Psalms is like the longest book in the Old Testament, so if you flip open anywhere, there's like a 70% chance you'll be in the Psalms. So you can just follow and get there. Hopefully by the end of the message, you will have found where we are. Okay, Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 8. I hear my lover coming. All right, this is the girl talking about the guy. He is leaping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. He's crazy about her, right? Here he is, the king of Israel, and he is bounding over the hills, skipping like a giddy schoolboy. Verse 9, my lover is like a swift gazelle or a young stag. Or in Roxborough speak, he's a stud. That's what she's saying. That's a straight translation of that. Look, there he is behind the wall, looking through the window, peering into the room. That's illegal, okay? I want to be clear on that. Some of you are like, the Bible's encouraging peeping Toms. What is that all about, right? No, it's just saying he's excited to see her. And actually what it's doing is it's setting up a metaphor that we're going to explore more in a moment. Okay, verse 10. My lover said to me, rise up, my darling. Come away with me. This is now the guy speaking to the girl. My fair one, look, the winter is past. The rains are over and gone. The flowers are springing up. The season of singing birds has come. And the cooing of turtle doves fills the air. The fig trees are forming young fruit, and the fragrant grapevines are blossoming. This is a depiction, obviously, of the time they fell in love. Now, spring is a common metaphor for falling in love, isn't it? Because when you fall in love, it feels like spring. For many people, being single is like living in a type of winter. No offense if you're single, but that's how some people describe it. It's like being in a kind of winter. But in spring, everything is bright and sunny. Everything is coming alive. Everybody is in a better mood in spring, aren't they? Right? Except when things happen like last night, because I can tell all you guys are ticked off, and I'm ticked off too. Didn't want to come to church this morning. But usually, everybody, right, is in a better mood in spring. And people in love are like that too sometimes. And that's what makes them so annoying to be around. Because there's just everything is great. You know, it's just because they're in love. I remember when our illustrious worship pastor, Chris Gaynor, sitting right up here beside his wonderful wife, first started to, when they got together, how long, when did y'all start dating? What year? Second time. December 2005 was round two of their dating experience. And as they were getting to know, rekindling this relationship, I'm telling you, man, Chris got in the absolute best mood. I don't know if you guys know this about Chris, but he's wound up pretty tight. Have y'all noticed that? And you don't mess with him on Sunday morning because, I mean, he's trying to run this thing so it runs smoothly. And he hates it when I throw stuff at him at the last minute when I'm up like, we got to do this in the service. And he's like, why? I'm like, the Spirit of God told me that. He's like, well, the Spirit of God should have told you on Wednesday that we were supposed to do that. That's right. The thing that he hates the most is when I throw something big on him like communion. Like Friday or Saturday, like, we need to do communion and rearrange the whole service. And he absolutely hates this. I remember it was like the second week that he was now dating Michelle. I came to him and I faced it. I was ready for the wrath. I was like, Chris, I really feel like we need to do a communion on Sunday and it's Friday. And I'll never forget, he was like, that's great. That's fine. Not a problem. I'll make the changes working. And at that moment, I knew that she was the one that he should marry for the rest of his life. And it's been much better since then, Chris, by the way. Everyone actually grateful for Michelle. Verse 13. Rise up, my darling, he says to her. Come away with me, my fair one. All right, guys. What I most want you to notice from this first section is that it is Solomon, you ready for this? That is taking the initiative with her. Solomon is the king of Israel, and I am sure that he has many pressing issues. Issues of national security and importance to deal with in the king's court. But he has taken the afternoon off to skip through the mountains and to romance his bride. And that is entirely the way that it is supposed to be. He is supposed to be the leader in romance. And I know that for some of you that is hopelessly out of date and old-fashioned. But the Bible is very clear all the way back in Genesis 2 and 3 specifically that God created the man to be the leader in the relationship in a number of different ways, okay? I'm not going to walk you through Genesis 2 and 3, but let me just summarize it for you. If you've come to our church, I'm sure you've heard me talk about this before. Then in Genesis 2, before there was even a woman on the scene, God created man with a job, right? He put him in the garden to tend it and to keep it, which shows us that man was to be a leader in providing for his family. Right, the second thing God did before the woman came around was he communicated to Adam the understanding about what the tree of life was and the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the guidelines for obedience, which means that he was to be a spiritual leader. God was going to bring in the woman into a relationship that the man already had with God and a provision that he was already making. And the implication is that was to be the man's role leading there. All right, after God, puts him to sleep and takes out one of his, something out of his side and makes the woman, when he wakes up, the first thing that he says in Genesis 2, verses 24 and 25, first words ever uttered by a human being in the Bible was a love poem to his wife, which shows you that he was to be a leader in romance. That was our first thing that we said. We were to lead in romance. Fourthly, the thing that he said was, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, which showed that he was to be a leader in protection. He was going to treat her like she was part of his own body because literally she was from part of his body. And so he was going to love her that way. And that leads me to number five. He was to lead in self-sacrifice. Paul would later say that he was to lead the woman like Christ led the church, meaning that he put her needs so far above his that when it came time, he would lay down his life for her. What you find in Genesis 3, that the whole fall was instigated by a failure on the man's part to lead spiritually. I know the original sin was taking of the forbidden fruit, and I know that Eve was the first one to do that. But if you'll let me be so bold to kind of cast a different light on it for you, there was actually a subtle sin happening before that sin. And that is Genesis 3 says that when the serpent was talking to the woman, it implies the man was standing right there. So instead of leading spiritually, he was sitting back on the couch with a bag of Doritos watching SportsCenter letting her take care of this stuff. The first sin of man was a sin of complacency. It wasn't that he did something bad, it was that he did nothing. Or you could say it like this, man's first sin was not a sin of commission, it was a sin of omission. And what you found is that because men weren't leading spiritually, the world fell into disarray. And the whole story of the Bible is that the world will not come back together until men, namely a man, in this case Jesus Christ, the second Adam, came to lead in the ways that Adam did not lead. And I would suggest that for you men in your marriages and in your family will not take the shape God wants it to take until you begin to lead spiritually. It's not that you're a bad husband and doing things that are bad. It's just that you're not there, right? You're not there. I don't mean physically not there. I mean you are complacent and you are not leading in that relationship, which is why God's first question to Adam and Eve was, where are you, Adam? You'd almost translate that him saying, where were you? Where were you leading? Why weren't you leading? Why weren't you leading? And you see that. That's all the way back in Genesis. And what you see is Solomon taking the initiative. He is leading in romance. Does that make sense? I mean, I don't feel like I'm pulling that out or stretching that. I think that's right in there is what he's saying. He's leading in this way. One critique that I have of Christian single men, if you will let me, and I'm right there with you when I was single, okay? So don't, Uncle JD's not coming down on you too hard. Listen, is that they are shiftless, especially in the area of romance. I have heard more Christian girls than I can tell you about complain that Christian guys just don't really seem to be upfront when it comes to declaring their intentions to a girl or romancing her. Right? They're just kind of going along, just like, well, I don't want to have that awkward conversation. Let's just sort of move in the relationship and see where it goes. I heard one Christian girl describe it. You girls know what I'm talking about, by the way? I see some of you nod your head and write names down in your notes. You know exactly what I'm talking about. All right, drawing arrows to people in the congregation. I heard one girl describe it as four military analogies. Okay, first of all, you got the stealth bomber guy. And what he does is he just kind of waits wherever he knows the girl's going to be, just kind of waits there and like is always there when she shows up. Like coming out of the bathroom out here in our lobby, he's just there. No matter where you show up, there he is, standing next to you in the choir. He's just always there. He's a stealth bomber. All right, the second one, she said, was the shock and awe approach. And that's where the guy comes on so strong, just always talking about himself, because he feels like if he can just woo you with all his massive, impressive things that he has done, then suddenly you'll just fawn at his feet and start to slobber and just completely give yourself over to him. And we call these guys me monsters around here. Because, oh, we don't talk about me. In fact, these are the kind of guys that say, I'm tired of talking about me. Why don't you, ma'am, talk about me for a while? That's guys like this, the shock and awe approach. The third one was the reconnaissance only guys, right? And that's guys that you never really know what they're doing. They just always seem to be where you are gathering information. They fly over, they circle, they stare. They stand next to you all without speaking. And they're just examples of social awkwardness. That's one kind. And then there's the secret agent, right? This is probably the biggest one. This is the kind of guy who always arranges times to hang out with you without ever declaring his intentions. Right, because that way, if he decides he doesn't want to have to go out with you, then he doesn't have to have the awkward DTR, defining or determining the relationship. And if you don't want to go out with him, he can avoid the humiliating rejection that comes from you saying no to him. Right, so he just kind of like, he's a sort of a secret agent, never really letting you know what happens. I saw the worst example of this on CNN this week. I was talking about a girl who is a college girl who evidently started to hang out with some guy she met at a party. And while they were at the party, he kissed her. And then when she got home later that night, she noticed that he had updated their status on his Facebook page to boyfriend, girlfriend. And that's how she found out about his intentions in the relationship. That is just the ultimate example, right? Of something that, come on now, the opposite of Solomon. He is up front. He is really clear with his intentions. He's not this spineless wimp, okay? Now, guys, listen, I know that you can, you know, some of you are like, well, but you can come on too strong too quickly and freak her out. I know that, okay? I realize that, and there's a lot of guys that do that. You know, in fact, it not always guys to girls. I mean, before I got married, I went to a Hardee's to grab a, you know, whatever they sell there, and I went into the big one, and so I went in, it was at 3 o'clock, and there was nobody else there in the whole restaurant except for me and these two girls that were behind the counter. And one of them was just a little more friendly than a fast food restaurant clerk is supposed to be. And so I go in to sit down. I'm the only one in the restaurant. And her friend, these are two good Southern girls, is sweeping the floor. And she keeps sweeping over toward me. Oh, yeah? And she sweeps by me for like 30 seconds. And I finally look up at her and she says, you see my friend so-and-so there? I said, yeah. She said, she wants to know if y'all can like start out being friends and then move on to something else. And can I get your phone number for her? I was like, oh, you need to slow down just a tad. And then I had one of the smartest thoughts I've ever had in my life. I said, you know, actually, I would love that. My name is Bruce Ashford, who was a best friend of mine. And I said, here's my cell phone number. And I wrote down the cell phone number and handed it to her. And said, please call me this afternoon because I'm really lonely. So, Bruce, you here this morning? All right. He comes here. Used to. You have to be... I know that you can freak her out by coming on too strong, guys. But you have to be sensitive when her heart is starting to get engaged. And you have to care enough about her to not take her on a journey where you have no clear intentions about where you're going or ever getting to the destination. Now, again, I know some of you guys and girls are saying that is so old school. Modern girls just aren't like that anymore. Solomon would beg to differ because Solomon is about to show you something very important, guys, about women that I would say is as true about most women today as it was back then, verse 14. He said, my dove, talking about her, my dove is hiding behind the rocks, behind an this is difficult. Don't you laugh. Behind an outcrop on the cliff. This girl, you see, has a certain fear. And it's indicative of the fact, and I would say applies to most girls, that usually, even more so than the guy, there is a fear with a girl about getting into a serious relationship. Because even more than the guy is doing, she is committing her whole life into the hands of a man. It's not just the biblical pattern. It's also something, I don't mean this to be offensive, but I would suggest the Creator hardwired into them. She is going out from under the protection and providence of her father, and she is going into the care and the unity with her husband, and the last thing she wants is a wishy-washy guy who doesn't really... isn't confident enough to invite her into a journey that he knows where he's going. All right, I have seen many relationships, many, where the girl got a little scared and backed off a little bit. And what needed to happen was for the guy to show some confidence. I'm not saying it's always this way. But what needed to happen was for the guy to show some confidence, and instead, he kind of backed off because he didn't want to experience the rejection, and he let the relationship fade. And as a result, it may cost him the relationship. I've seen relationships like this. In fact, in the spirit of full disclosure, I will tell you the time that Veronica and I came most close to breaking up was over this very issue. I told you that when I after we met, I went over to Indonesia for a couple years, and we began to write. She began to fill my email inbox with just letters begging me to go out with her, and threatening to do bodily harm to herself. And so finally, I was like, "Fine." No, I'm kidding. Actually, in that one, I took the initiative. I was writing her probably 3-1. And I was writing her and pursuing her. Well, about halfway through the 2 years there, I came home to the United States and was going to be home for about 2 weeks. And so I arranged to go see her. I drove down there and I go see her and I knock on the door and she opens the door. And in her telling the story, which I'm deferring to hers because I have a different interpretation. When I knocked on the door, she, smiled. And I gave her one of those kind of Christian fellowship side hug kind of deals, like, hey, sister, how are you, sort of things. And the whole weekend that I spent with her at her house with all of her friends and her parents, it was just very, I never was really clear about anything. I just kind of like was, this is sort of what it is. Now, I was trying to like play it cool and not, because I was like, I got another year over there. And I thought it went great. She thought it was horrible. I left her in emotional turmoil because I thought we were going somewhere and he never even acknowledged our relationship. He treated me like a pastor would treat somebody in his congregation. Right. So I go back over overseas and I think things are fine. So I start writing her again. And I noticed that when she writes me back, which is a little less frequent, she's bringing up, I just see the recurrence of this guy's name, number of times. And finally, I was like, why do you keep bringing this guy up? And she says, well, we've started to hang out a little bit. I wrote her back a one-line email that said, I'm not sure how I feel about that relationship. She writes me back a one-line email that says, what do you mean you're not sure how you feel about that relationship? And I said, all I mean is I'm not sure how I feel about that relationship. All right, I get back this 8-page email that just reamed me out. I mean, just, and deservedly, she was like, you're playing with my emotions, you're saying we're going one place, and then you communicate something else, and I never know what you're thinking, and one day we're on, one day we're off, and she just laid it out. Now, I didn't respond immediately, because at that point, I knew I had her, and so I sat on that email, and I was like, that's right, she wants a microphone, no. So I sat on it. Cole Mill, my wife, is sitting right here, in case you're wondering. I sat on it for three days. Didn't write her back. And so I sat down one night, about 11 o'clock, and I wrote her back and just said, this is what, you know, I think about you. This is where I think we should go. And I laid it all out. Seriously, it was 8-9 pages. It took me 3 hours to write that email. I got ready to hit send. The computer locked up, lost everything, which was the divine judgment of God upon me, okay? I knew that. So I got so mad, I went to bed. I couldn't sleep. 10 minutes later, I was up, started at 2 o'clock, wrote again all the way to 5 o'clock and sent it to her. And thus, we've lived happily ever after. But what I'm telling you is the time that I most came close to messing that up was because I just wasn't clear with my intentions with her, right? Now, girls, let me tell you this. If a guy is clear with his intentions with you and he doesn't do it too quick, you know, he doesn't come on too strong, I know you may not be interested, and that's okay. But you need to have the dignity and the respect for him to acknowledge that and be clear about your intentions. In fact, you maybe even just say, hey, you know, in a world full of pansies, I respect the fact that you have the guts to tell me what your intentions are. I have no interest in you whatsoever, okay? He may be hurt a little bit, but listen, he'll get the hint. At least, and guys, you need to get the hint, right? They should need to have you tell you that more than two or three times. But girls, most guys will get the hint. Now, I realize, you know, not all of them. Guys, you know, you don't want to be like this. Just take a look up here.
I like you, Mary. I like you a lot. I want to ask you a question straight out, flat out. I want you to give me the honest answer. What do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say, and we really don't...
Hit me with it! Just give it to me straight! I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just... least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance. Yeah! I read you.
All right. So, guys, don't be dumb and dumber. Now, again, I know some of you are like, man, that's so outdated. Listen, there was a survey on ChristianSingles.com. Yes, there exists such a site. And, yes, it's even more amazing that I was on it. And... there was a question about that asked the question to single guys and girls, is it okay for a girl to make the first move in the relationship? Fascinating, okay? The majority of guys said yes. It is okay for a girl to make the move. In fact, one guy named Michael said this. It helps the man avoid the embarrassment of being rejected by someone who's not really interested in him, right? But the majority of the girls that responded said no. We still want the guy to make the first move. In fact, a reader named Kathy said, guys today appear to be gutless. It takes far too much hinting to even get them to wake up. We want real men back. Okay, so we all said amen. Thank you. Good. All right. Now, don't worry, guys. Solomon shows you how to do this. Okay? Uncle Solomon, take care of you. Pick up again, verse 14. What he says. Let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, because your voice is pleasant and your face is lovely. Somebody in the first service said, whenever you read Song of Solomon, you shift into your ladies' man voice. That's how he said it, okay? Now, she's like a dove. Remember that analogy? She's like a dove, which means there's a certain shyness that goes along with her. So how does he call her out, right? By listening to her. Because women are not to be stalked like prey. Right? I mean, you know, this verse doesn't go like, there she is, a dove. You know, and he puts his sights on it. It's not how it goes. The way that he calls her out is that he gives her security. And how does he do it? He does it by listening to her, by trying to understand her, by trying to know her on a soul level. You see, that's where the analogy there in verse 9 comes in. He is looking behind the wall, looking through the window. The word for look in Hebrew means a very intense stare where he doesn't take his eyes off of her. And it's not trying to imply he's a pervert stalker. It's setting up a metaphor that that's the way he looks into her heart. He looks into her heart, and that gives her a feeling of such great security that she is willing to become part of his life. William Harley wrote a book almost 20 years ago that is a classic and a favorite of mine called His Needs, Her Needs, in which he explained that the problem is that most people go into relationships thinking that their partner has the same basic set of needs that they themselves do. And what Dr. Harley's book is about is how to show you that's not at all true. Because guys and girls are wired very differently. Neurobiologists tell us that there are over 100 million differences simply in the brain wiring of men and women alone. Right? Anybody that's married realizes this. It's like the great myth when you go into marriage is that you think you're marrying a long-haired version of yourself with just a different set of plumbing. But you find somebody totally different. It's in things as small as how my wife and I, the pillows on our bed. You're like, what? There's like 192 pillows on our bed. It takes me a half hour to get into bed at night because I'm moving all those pillows. I need two. That's all I need. One to put my head on, one to hold in case she's not available. That's it. That's all I need. She thinks about it differently. And what William Harley does is he shows you that there are five basic assumptions, needs, if you want to call them that, that men go into relationships with. Okay, the first need they go into, no surprise, sex. Right? That's the first thing when you're thinking about marriage. That's like their big need. Then the second one is respect. They want admiration. They want somebody to tell them how great they are. That's their need, expectation going in. They want recreational companionship, which means they want somebody that, you know, just has fun with them, plays with them. Right? Then they want a beautiful spouse. And by that, Dr. Harley doesn't mean that she has to look like she's, you know, 19 for the rest of her life. It just means she's takes care of herself. She respects herself enough to maintain a level of beauty. The next thing he wants is tranquility and peace at home, so he has somewhere safe he feels like he can come home to. Girls, totally different. Different set of needs. They approach their biggest expectation and need is they need affection. And usually, guys, unfortunately for you, that doesn't primarily or really even mostly refer to sex. She needs conversation. Right, Dr. Harley says 15 hours of conversation a week is what a man should aim at with his wife. Huh? That's right. Are you there yet? I'm not there yet, but I mean, I understand that's a big deal. In fact, one of my premarital couples, I never get tired of telling the story, I was going through this list of needs with him, and somehow the guy heard that she gets 15 hours of conversation and he gets 15 hours of sex a week. I was like, good luck with that one, okay? That's not the way it works. But she needs conversation because that's how she relates. She needs stability, both financial and familial stability, meaning that she needs a safe family. She needs to know that financially she's going to be taken care of. She needs a guy that will give her significance, number four. A guy that will give her significance, a guy that will say, hey, you're home, yes, but I value you and I esteem you and I appreciate you, and a guy that puts significance on her, especially if she's not in the workplace. Lastly, she needs a guy that is absolutely trustworthy. A guy that she knows she can trust, the guy who never lies to her, and that he is completely, he's just a guy with integrity. Most guys don't understand this, so they spend most of their time completely bewildered in their relationships. Somebody in our church shared with me, I've shared this with you before, but this is how he felt going into his marriage, this little control dial up here, right? He's like, that's me, that's her. I never know what, is going on with her. But that's simply, guys, listen, I have good news. Solomon has good news for you. All right? And that is her basic, take that off. Her basic five needs can all be boiled down into a simple description that if you will dedicate yourself to this, you will make a lot of progress. I think it's what Solomon would say. And that is security and intimacy. Security and intimacy, and those two very much go together. This difference, is probably nowhere the difference between guys and girls on this scene than in a woman's approach toward communication. But ladies, have you noticed that guys are really bad listeners? And that's because we use words totally differently than you do. For guys, words are like tools, right? You use them to fix stuff. And if there's nothing broken, why would you need to pull out the tool? I don't just carry it around, right? I mean, for girls, however, her words are a way of connecting in the relationship. And it's a way that they develop intimacy. I remember, this was first, like the first 2 years of our marriage, sometime in there. Veronica had a flat tire. She tried to get a hold of me. I wasn't available. She wasn't mad about that. But she came home. There was a donut on the car that she, you know, some nice person had helped her put on. And so she starts to tell me. She spends about 20 seconds. And so I said, so what you're telling me is there's a donut on the back of the car. She said, yeah. I said, I'll have that fixed by tomorrow morning. I thought that was extremely loving. I just offered to take care of her problem. I was going to pull out my tools and just going to take care of it. That's not what she wanted. Right? She wanted me to relive the experience with her. The fact that I would fix it was just assumed. But she wanted me to know how she felt. She wanted me to relate and to understand, and I blew it. I totally blew it. I was like, no. I mean, right? It's just how we use. That's why when you see a group of girls talking and a group of guys talking, you ever notice? It's totally different. But the girls are all talking at one time. You know, all going at each other. The guys are talking one at a time, but it's not because they're listening to each other. Right? They're thinking about how to one-up what that guy over there just said. And the whole time, like, yeah, I got this right here. Right. They use words totally differently, which is why Solomon, watch this, guys. He tells you how to listen. Last part of verse 14. I hear your voice. I see your face. He listens with both his ears and his eyes. It drives my wife crazy when she's talking and I am multitasking. Right? I mean, she's, you know, talking about something and I know what she's saying. And so I'm multitasking. And she's like, would you please listen to me? And I'm like, I am listening to you. And I repeat back to her everything she just said to me. She says, I want you to listen with your face, okay? Stop what you're doing and just listen to me, all right? That's how he communicates with her. Let me apply this across the board to maybe where some of you are. For you that are dating, I would suggest that you devote yourself to learning the skill of listening, okay? Learning the skill of listening. I've heard it said that a lot of times people resort to showing affection simply by physical touch. And what I mean by that is, you know, touching their hand, putting your arm around them. I'm not talking about sexual. I mean just, that's a very easy way to show affection, isn't it? It doesn't take any forethought. It doesn't take any preparation or planning, but it shows a great deal of affection. What happens, though, is that in marriage, the effect of that wears off. So if the only way you know how to show affection is by touching, then you have not really achieved the way to have a lifetime of good communication. So in dating, when touch communicates so much, I would suggest that you not let that handicap you, and you would devote yourself to learning to become a good listener, because that is going to be crucial as you enter into the rest of your life, okay? Girls, let me just give a little Uncle JD comment here. All right, you want a guy that listens to you. And if he doesn't do it now, I promise you he's not going to do it in marriage. People have this myth that when they get married, it's going to take care of all their problems. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? Right? And that's like saying you can bench press, you can't lift 70 pounds. So let's slap 300 on there and see how I can do with that. Right? I mean, my wife, you know, there's people that are like, oh, we never fight when we're dating. It's like every other couple comes in and tells me that. They're the one big exception. They're not going to fight. And I mean, seriously, this is one of the few times that I laugh in their face. Right? My wife and I, up to our wedding day, never fought. And then, oh yeah. In fact, I'm not exaggerating. I'm not trying to, you know, do the elastic exaggeration here. We figured out that the things that irritated us about each other, if you would multiply them by an intensity of 4 and stretch it out to a duration of 3, that's what our marriage life was like. So take whatever irritates you most about that person, the most irritated you've ever been, amplify it by 4, stretch it out by 3, and that's your life as a married person. And so if you don't know how to communicate, right, it's going to be bad news. So you need to find a guy that will listen and that will communicate, and marriage isn't going to just fix the problem. One more thing, girls, Uncle JD. Just because a guy listens to you now, even if he gets down on this level and wants to know you, that doesn't always mean he's legit. Because guys are exceptionally good at closing the deal. And we figured out how this whole thing works, some of us. And so they start listening and asking questions. Yeah, that isn't, you need to, I don't know how to tell you to do this, you just got to develop discernment. And usually your friends can see it before you. Right? Because it's why I tell girls, never, ever, 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 ever believe anything a guy says after 8 p.m. Because if he didn't say it before 8 p.m., I promise you he didn't mean it. He's just saying it after 8 p.m. because he's got other intentions on his mind. All right, so that's, for those of you that are dating, you have to develop the skill and appreciate it. For those of you that are married, I don't feel like I even need to say this. I mean, I feel like it's so unbelievably obvious that I'm insulting you by even spelling this out. Guys, you stink, and me, at leading and continuing to do this after we get married. I mean, when Veronica and I were dating, after we got through that little issue right in the middle of the 2 years over there, our phone bills were unbelievably high. Because I'm calling her back from Indonesia, and I'm like, oh, sweetheart, just put the phone down beside you, go to sleep there on the couch, and let me listen to you breathe. You know, just, I just want to hear you, you know, and then after you get married, you're like, yeah, wrap it up, give me a point, okay? I developed this little thing in our marriage that I quickly discarded, and that would, I use the word noun, because my wife would, you know how like you put all your, in other languages, you put your noun first and then your adjectives later, and that's like a better way of communicating, because then you know what you're talking about, so a house, big, white, you know, well, in English, you do it reverse. Well, I was like, baby, that's what you do with your words, is I don't even know what you're talking about until like 10 minutes into the conversation. So, and so she was talking, I would just say, noun. Give me the noun that you're talking about. Horrible idea, okay? All right, that's not a good idea. I just like, hey, you talk all you want, all right? You can't let this falter. You have to continue to take the lead there, right? I mean, I'll prove it to you. Guys, if you don't do this, go to a restaurant with your wife. You see a couple over in the corner. They're at a table. He's holding her hand and stroking her hand as they talk. He's not watching the sports center that's behind her. He's focused on her, looking in her eyes. He's following and nodding his head. What do you think? Dating, newlywed, or having an affair? Right? Because you just don't see married people act that way. And guys, if you'll even let me go a step farther, this is exactly why women get seduced into affairs. Their reason for going into affairs and guys are usually completely different. With girls, it's not as overtly sexual as it usually is for the guy, not at least in the physical sense. It is because suddenly there is a guy who pays attention to them. It's not that she just has got a sex drive that's out of control. It's because she's found a guy who listens to her soul, who asks about her day, who notices things that she is wearing, who notices what kind of perfume she is wearing, who knows when she looks sad, when she looks like she has something on her, and he knows how to say, hey, you look like you got a lot on you right now. Tell me what's going on. And suddenly those emotional connectors go out of there, and before, I'm not excusing her, but before she even knows what's happening, she's in love with another guy because you weren't taking the lead in listening and coaxing her out with that relational security and intimacy. Does that make sense? Okay. Are you sure? Women, guys, wives, excuse me. Some of your husbands are going to realize some things, hopefully through this series, that they're really going to want to change. And the easiest thing for you, and I see it all the time, is you don't want to forgive them. You want to beat them over the head. Just let it go. Would you let today start a new beginning for them? If they're writing something down in their notes right now, you take that as the fact that they're writing down something they need to change. And you just say, I'm going to let everything go up to now. Because now I realize that you realize what I'm like, and let him start over again. Okay? You can do that. Yes, you can. Underlying all of this is the truth that an important part of a healthy relationship, you see, is finding someone that you feel comfortable bearing your soul to. And who is interested in that? Somebody that can see through the windows of your soul and who wants to do that. Someone that you don't mind letting them see the bad in your past. And someone that you will disclose your future expectations to and who is excited about that. Someone you feel you can share the deepest parts of you. Now, whenever we deal with this question, people usually ask, when is the appropriate time to do that? Because here you could probably go wrong by doing it too quickly, too soon also, right? Exactly. It's not the kind of thing you put on your Facebook page and forward to them. Here's my expectations. Here's all the mistakes I've made. I'm going to bare my soul to you and let you fill out an application to see if we should go out. Right? That's not what I'm talking about. Tommy Nelson makes a very helpful distinction when he talks about this. He taught a series on Song of Solomon. It's very helpful. But he talked about a distinction that I completely agree with. And he says, let's call one the first level dating, and let's call the second level courtship. Third level will be engagement. In dating, that's where, what I told you last week, it's non-exclusive, it's non-escalating, and it's non-physical. That's when you're in high school, your first years of college. We're not talking about going out one-on-one a lot. We're saying, I'm not ready to get married, but I'd like to get to know some guys, their character, so I don't want it to be physical or sexual in any way. I don't want it to be escalating or exclusive. So we go out, we hang out in groups, and we keep that emotional, romantic, you know, fervor to a minimum because I don't want to obscure my view of that person. But the second level is courtship. And that is where the guy has declared his intentions. This is something that is very real to me, he will say. And this is where I want to go, and I want you to go with me. And when he enters into that phase of the relationship, that is when it's probably appropriate for you to begin to show some of the depths of your soul, him to you and you to him. All right? Because the last thing you want is for that to come out in marriage, and it will. Let me get really down and dirty with this. Guys, you got a problem with pornography? You need to tell her that. You really do. Because that will come out in your marriage. I know that many of you are working, you know, on that. It's a big deal to you, and that needs to come out during that time. Right? If you've lost your virginity, guys or girls, that probably needs to come out. Right? Your future, your expectations come out during that time. It never ceases to amaze me how many couples get ready to get married and they don't have any idea what the other person expects out of life. I don't know how many kids you want to have. I don't know what the guy expects the girl. I don't know what you expect me to do after we have kids. You expect me to stay home? Do you expect me to do this or that? They just never really talk about that. In fact, there's a great movie out right now. Actually, it's not that great, but it makes a good point, called License to Wed. That has that very thing as its premise. They don't know each other at all. They're just kind of hanging out and going along, and they've never really gotten to know the actual other person. So you want to devote yourself during that time to making those secrets come out. Don't gloss over, because it will come out. All right? We're not far from being done with this passage, but we got just a handful of little thoughts left. Look at this, verse 15. Catch all the foxes, those little foxes, before they ruin the vineyard of love. For the grapevines are blossoming. Right? This, by the way, is her now speaking to him. And he says to her, hey, the garden is starting to bloom. We're starting to fall in love. But there's these little foxes that are going to eat up the blooms. What that is in Hebrew, in the ancient Israeli culture. In that culture, what you would have is these little foxes that when the grapevine started to bloom, they would come under the fence and they would nip at the buds. Before it even turned into grapes, and they would eat it so that it destroyed the harvest. And what he's saying, or what she is saying to him is, in the garden of our love, there are a number of little foxes, small things, that will destroy our relationship. And you, Solomon, you've got to keep those out of our relationship. Now, question, what are those little foxes? He doesn't list them. She doesn't list them either. That's because they're different in just about every relationship. You see, what I find, listen to this, is that there are a lot of great relationships that go bad, not because they're wrong for each other, but because of these little foxes. Let me disclose something else to you, all right? You've never wanted to admit this, but I'm about to call you out. Almost every married person goes through at least one time in their life where they think, I married the wrong person. And you think you're the only one who thinks that, but everybody thinks that at some point, because you married a sinner and not Jesus Christ. And when that sin comes out, you think, man, I just didn't know what I was getting into. Usually, it's not because it really is the wrong person. Usually, it's because of one of these little foxes, a little thing that has become huge. Now, again, what are they? He doesn't list them, but I'll tell you what I observe as a pastor most often. Usually, it's bad communication habits. That's the first one. They're not wrong for each other. They just don't know how to talk to each other. Bad communication habits, which is why we offer these monthly seminars. One of them is specifically devoted to communication. Because we know you don't know how to do it, right? So we're going to study the Bible together, and you ought to be a part of that. Another one is using your spouse as an idol. This is a huge one. I see it all the time. It's not that they're wrong for you. It's that you are now looking to them for something you ought to find in Jesus. And so you begin to suck the life out of that person because you are so needy and incomplete that you're thinking they can salvage your needy soul. That's why C.S. Lewis in The Four Loves said there's two kinds of love. One is need love and one is gift love. Need love sucks a person dry. Gift love is complete before the other person and has a way to give to the other person. It's why I tell married, pre-married couples, you're not ready to date until you're ready not to date. Because if you think a person you date or marry is going to deal with your problems of insecurity and loneliness, you are wrong. Because lonely, insecure single people become lonely, insecure married people. Because problems like loneliness and security aren't found in other people, they're found in Jesus. And you turn that person into an idol and is your source of worth, and you crush them. Again, it's why, and if you come to our church, you've heard me say this, it's why I tell every premarital couple I deal with, you need to put a sign on the forehead of your future spouse. That's like one of those signs when you're driving through the mountains and you come up to an old bridge that says, you know, will not support 2 tons. Don't drive your Mack truck across this. You need to put a sign up there that says, will not support the weight of your soul. Don't look to that person for something that Jesus is supposed to do. And a lot of marriages go bad because they turn them into an idol. It's a little fox. Here's one. Not knowing how to forgive is another one I see a lot. It's a small fox. It's a little tiny thing. But it becomes a big deal because you don't know how to forgive. You know, Veronica and I, we go periodically, time to time, we see a marriage counselor. Because I want our relationship to be good. Right? And I'm not perfect. I don't know everything. And so we have outside sources that look at us and tell us things. And I forget, several years into our marriage, one of them said, your problem is actually very small. It's a garden variety problem. You think it's a huge deal. You think it's almost a deal breaker, but it's not. The problem is small. You just don't know how to forgive. And because you know how to forgive, that small fox has ravaged the garden of your love. Small things. Yeah, I put one other one down here. Sexual addictions, that's one. Guys go into their marriage and with pornography and they don't get control of it. And the girl ends up thinking it's about her because she's not attractive, and you know that usually has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with her attractiveness. It has to do with this little fox called self-discipline that you've never gotten under control, and it destroys your marriage. Little foxes. Now, guys, watch this. I want you to notice again that she says it to him. He's supposed to take the lead in this. How many times when people come into our offices at the church for counseling in their marriage, is it not the woman dragging the man who doesn't even know something's wrong in the relationship? Right? They're not even aware that something is a problem because they're on autopilot. And they're not even aware these little foxes are there. Guys, you are supposed to be the leader in every single part of that romance and that relationship, which means that when it's time and there's a problem, you identify it, and you are the one who takes the steps to it, to remedy it. I got very convicted a few years ago because I realized that I was spending an immense amount of time praying and planning and vision casting and thinking about my job, which is this church. And I realized that at my home, I just had it on autopilot. It wasn't that I was a bad husband. I just didn't think about it. It's just, yeah, I'm there. I mean, that makes me a good husband, right? With my kids, I wasn't a bad father. It's just that I didn't have any intentions about how I was trying to raise up my kids. That was mainly her deal, and I was just there at home to play with them at night. And I decided, you know what? My church, my ministry, my job is never going to come at greater intensity to me than that first ministry God's given me, which is my family. And I will spend time thinking about where our relationship is, where our family is. I'm going to be the leader in it, and I'm going to take responsibility for it. And God help me if I spend more time doing that for you than I even do my own family, because that's my first ministry. You see? Look at this. Let me wrap this up pretty quickly here. Well, you know what that means for me. I heard a leader of the feminist movement in the 1960s. Well, I read it. She said, "We have finally become the men that we always wanted to marry." We finally become the men we always wanted to marry. Because, guys, the sin was a sin of complacency. It was a sin not that you did something bad. It's just that you did nothing. Verse 16, "My lover is mine," she says, "and I am his." A lot of you ladies, when I talk about male leadership, you develop this wall. Something inside you reacts because you think it sounds like male dominance. There is a mutual ownership that she is talking about. I am his, he is mine. In Ephesians 5, before it tells the woman, the wife, to submit to the husband, verse 24 says, you should submit to each other. It's the same concept, mutual ownership. I own you, you own me. So that my leadership of you is not a way of getting you to conform to my needs. Because before you follow me as a leader, I lead like Christ, which fully gives myself to you, which means I'm going to put your needs above mine. Now, let me be really upfront with you. The Bible is not sugarcoated at all. It makes no bones about it. The guy's supposed to be the leader in the relationship. But guys, it says to you that you are to love and lead her like Christ leads the church, which means you never use your leadership as a way of commandeering the relationship to meet your own needs. It means that your leadership is given to you so that you can prioritize her and the relationship so that just like Jesus, you would lay down your life before letting her need, one of her needs go unmet. That's what it means. Which is why I said to you frequently, spiritual leadership, guys, is not license to do what you want to do. It is empowerment to do what you ought to do. And the authority that God has given me is not an authority that I use to serve myself. It's given to me so that I can serve the relationship. Here's what I want you to do with that one. Girls, if you cannot follow him, if you recognize that he uses his leadership as a way of lording his authority over you, if he's abusive with his power or his authority, then you need to get out of the relationship. If you cannot follow him, this is if you're single. If you cannot follow him, if you cannot submit to his leadership, if he abuses it, get out. Without a second thought. Guys, if the girl that you're with won't follow your leadership, even though you are putting the relationship and her interest above your own, then I would suggest to you that probably is not the relationship you want to be in either. And you probably ought to get out as well, because you got much bigger issues. This is a serious thing that God gave us for the harmony of our relationship, and you do it. I originally did this all to verse 5, so let me just, chapter 3, let me just wrap this up by showing you this. Verse 1, one night as I lay in bed, I yearned for my lover, I yearned for him, but he did not come. And then she goes on to recount a dream. She's going to tell you about this dream she had. I won't go through the dream, but I will show you this. It leads me to say, this is, again, more of an Uncle JD comment. I'm not sure if I can pull this out of this passage, to be totally honest with you. But it just leads me to say this. If you, in this story, you see a couple that is completely consumed with each other, they can't imagine life without the other one. If you can imagine life without that person you're dating, then break up. Only marry somebody you can't live without. That's just more practical from what I've seen, honestly. In fact, I'm sure I'll get some hate mail about this, but I'll go ahead and say it anyway. When in doubt, break up. You're like, what if it's wrong? Well, if you find that you can't live without that person, you will find your way back together, I am sure. If not, then you shouldn't have been with them anyway. I've seen very few couples who broke up and didn't get back together who should have been together, but I have seen a ton, more than I can tell you about, who should not have been together and went toward marriage that probably was not the best for them. So when in doubt, break up. Verse 5, promise me, O women of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and the wild deer, not to awaken love until the time is right. You recognize that's the same warning he ended the last little thing with? Or she did, excuse me? Again, listen. Sexual stimulation in the dating process sabotages the whole thing, because it keeps you from being able to see and develop the things that Solomon is saying is so necessary for a relationship. Which is why, even if you leave God out of it, leave God out of it entirely, you abstain from sexual stimulation pre-marriage, because it will simply mess up the patterns of what a good marriage are. I am not joking when I tell you, knowing what I know now, even if I did not believe in God, I would say sex before marriage is a bad idea. Because in sex, what you have is the ultimate act of oneness between a man and a woman. And it is designed by God to be accompanied by oneness in every other area. I am married to my wife, which means we are one financially, emotionally, spiritually. Everything about us is one. And so that physical act of oneness, that dynamite, that fire, right? It's there in the appropriate context, and it enhances the oneness that's everywhere else. And when you put that oneness, that dynamite, in an area where you don't have oneness and everywhere else, it will destroy and consume the relationship. Which is why she says, in this process, do not awaken love until it's time. Don't let it get out of control, because it will sabotage you and mess you up. All right? We'll come back to that. Why don't you bow your heads and, oh, wait a minute. Not yet. I forgot your homework. Go on your date. Guys, you got your pen out? Here's what I want over your dinner. I want you to say to the girl. Do you feel like I listen to you? I want you to use the word feel. And I want you not to evaluate the soundness of her logic in the answer she gives you. I don't care, and I'm not being derogatory, I don't care how ridiculous what she says sounds to you. You do not argue with one word of it. You go, uh-huh, mm-hmm, and you write it down. Mm-hmm, uh-huh, that's right. Mm-hmm, uh-huh, and you write every word of it down. Do you feel like I listen to you? If you want to argue with it, then wait a day. Girls, here's what I want you to say to the guy. Do you feel like I respect you and follow your leadership? And you guys see where that leads you. If you're single, if you're not in a relationship, what I'd love for you to do is take that silhouette I asked you to come up with last week of the character of the person that you want to marry. Why don't you spend this week going through the scriptures and finding scripture that goes with the characteristics you mentioned so that you are sure that you are looking for what the Bible says makes for a godly man or woman. All right? Now, here, Cole Mill, you guys bow your heads. Father, thank you for your word, which is so rich and applicable to us. Father, my prayer has been that you would show some in this room, not only in saving their marriages or saving their future marriages, but you would show some how unbelievably relevant and insightful the Bible is. And so, Father, I pray that that happens this morning. I also pray that for those, Lord, whose souls are thirsty because they've never found the fountain of love, which is Jesus, that they would not be deceived into thinking that happiness and fulfillment comes from another human being, but it only comes from the love which comes to us from the cross, a love of unconditional giving and forgiving. God, I pray that they would develop a taste for that love. Jesus, take your word, let your Holy Spirit give us light. I ask that, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.